Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, Hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Fell into Food Podcast. I am your host, Chef Jeff Fell, and with me today, Kim Olson, VP of Operations of Chicago's own Stan's Donuts. So thanks for coming on, Kim.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
We have so many different things and so many places that this can go. So I'll give you the pick of the litter. Do we go right into Stan's? Do we talk your culinary background and journey? Which one do you want to go with?
I think we should start with my journey because okay. It will end us up at Stan's.
Yeah, for sure. So although she's VP of operations, you have done a lot on the true chef culinary side. So maybe dig into how you got into it, why you got into it, and I guess what kept you here. I know we're all of us in the food industry are a little crazy. So maybe go into that. And I apologize if you're watching because you're going to have to see me munch on donuts. She was kind enough to bring some. So I'm going to be drinking some milk and eating some donuts. So I'm actually not going to apologize because this is going to be fun for me while I get to listen to Kim give her background. So take it away.
Yeah. And when I was a kid in high school, my first quote unquote legal job was working for a private health club in the city. I say legal because I think at one point in the industry, we all work sort of under the table working for cash, but no one ever said that. That's just for fun. And so my first job at this exclusive private health club, I'm like, great. I'm a cashier on the Sun Deck. And it's a lot of fun because there's a lot of celebrities and, you know, the guys are showing me how to cook a little bit. And I'm loving every element of it. And so it was just a means to an end at that point. It was just trying to get exposure, make a living and help pay bills at home. And so that was a lot of fun. And the chefs that I worked with there, everything at that health club was made from scratch. So every dressing, it was a health club. So we were doing things that weren't done before, you know, so turkey burgers, turkey meatloaf. And keep in mind, this is 25 years ago. So packaged meals to go were not really a thing. It wasn't relevant then. And we were the first doing it. And so we had a gourmet food shop. And so the chefs came and they're like, you really sort of have something special, right? So I'm like, no, I'm going to go and be a lawyer. I want to be in family law. I had a difficult childhood coming up and I really was passionate about the law situation and I wanted to help other families in my particular situation. So they were like, yeah, that's great, but you're actually just going to stay in culinary. And I was like, I don't really think so. And so I worked at that job until I graduated high school, in which I did apply to all the culinary schools because it was sort of a love-hate relationship, you know, to start being in the kitchen.
Yeah.
You were naturally a misfit. Like there was always some type of family dysfunction that brought you to the kitchen, mm-hmm. which I think that so many chefs can resonate with. And so I naturally fit in with the guys and I really decided to pursue it simply out of someone telling me that I couldn't do it. And so 25 years ago, being a female in the kitchen was unheard of. You know, there were very few of us and it was tough as nails. You had to be one of the guys to fit in. So, you know, every swear word that you can imagine, whether it was Spanish or English, we said it and we did it all. And times have changed dramatically since then, right? But just to progress that career, they all encouraged me to go to culinary school. They were all very, very supportive. My executive chef was from the CIA. My executive sous chef was from Johnson & Wales. And then I had a couple of guys that had gone to school locally in Chicago, and everyone's like, apply to them, and if you get in, go to CIA. You just need to go. And I was like, even the Johnson & Wales guy is telling me the CIA yeah. because the name meant something and it was meant to carry you along in your career. And so I did. I went to CIA 3 weeks after graduating high school. Really immersive program. 21 months you graduate.
So does that give you the 2-year or the 4-year?
It gives you the 2-year associate's degree in applied science. And that's in Hyde Park, New York. And unfortunately, I went at a time that was really challenging. That year was the year of 9/11. And so relocating my quiet life of Chicago as a newly graduated student from high school and going to big, scary New York, right? Because according to my family, New York City and Hyde Park, New York are the same thing. They don't know the difference. And so I did relocate there. I did the whole program and I loved it. And I was very intentional and very careful on where I chose to work thereafter. Again, I needed to work with companies that aligned with my values and really understood that we were trying to make a change for the better and making a way for female leaders in this industry. That career progressed me to a private golf club, which I was like, this is not my cup of tea.
Yeah, where everyone is your boss.
Everyone is your boss. And then I went on to do some other fun things with my career. I spent 7 years with Westin Hotels when it was a Starwood brand. And I love that because I got to see and meet so many new people and open new hotels. And that just became such a passion project. And so from there, I really started to work with younger school age children, doing mentorship programs and visiting the White House and going to see schools that needed help building culinary programs and explaining to children why you need to taste food and taste it over and over again to get exposure. Mm-hmm. I grew up kind of in a small world, if you will. So my mom was like the type of person, she didn't want to waste money. So if I wanted to try raspberries, she didn't like raspberries. And she was like, you're not going to like that. I'm not wasting my money on that. And so I didn't try some of these things until I was in college, quite literally. Because I was like, oh, the raspberry has fur on it. No, I don't want it.
So did you change your mindset? Because I kind of went through the same thing. Yeah. I grew up tiny town USA. You don't, there's not a lot of options. Walmart is your only grocery store.
Yeah.
So that's what you get. And the same thing, we grew up eating whatever we could grow. Exactly. Realistically and hunt. That's just kind of how we grew up. I mean, well, there was obviously things from the grocery store, but it wasn't getting a ton of stuff all the time. And I found that when I decided, same thing, to make the move from tiny town USA up to, I went to JJC. I was like, oh my God, the world, there's so much. And I think I just had to switch my mindset of, I'm going to have to try these things that I've never tried. I think I don't like them.
Yep.
Because I want to do this as a career. And I'm assuming it's kind of the same thing.
Same exact mentality is like, how could I serve this to someone and not know what it is? Or, you know, what does it taste like? Or what does it have a texture of? And so that really sort of changed my perspective on the world of food and the possibilities that you can have with food. So that sort of segued my career path. When I was with Westin, I came back. I had relocated down to Indianapolis for a time when I was with that group because I was pursuing to be an executive chef. And I had made my way up. I was exec sous for them out in the hotel in Wheeling here in Chicago, Illinois, close proximity suburb, right? And they were like, we want you to have exec chef, but we need you to go and take this in another state. And I was like, No, like I want it here in Chicago. They're like, we'll give it to you, but we need you to secure this position. And so I went hesitantly because I was going from a very great market into a convention hotel. And so that was a very different game. I was doing bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs all the time, weddings and pharmaceutical groups. And so you come from really high-end profile events and going into conventions, which there's nothing wrong with that. But convention hotel business is really different. It's all about volume. It's all about numbers. And the main reason they wanted me to go was because we were hosting the Super Bowl in a year and a half at that point.
Got it.
And so they needed someone who could sort of balance both the volume and the quality. Unfortunately, that time frame was when the recession hit and I got stuck there for far too long. And so when I came back to Chicago, I really wanted to do something that was impactful. Everything I had done to my point in that career was working for hotels or restaurant groups that had exclusivity to it. I wasn't open to the masses. I wasn't doing anything public where I could have my family come and visit. You know, if I wanted them to come to the health club, they had to be a member. If I wanted them to come and see me, you know, 40 miles up at Wheeling, they had to book a hotel room and have a private event, like a catering event, because we didn't have a restaurant. And so I really wanted to do something different. So when I relocated here, I worked for the Museum of Science and Industry.
Oh, that's awesome.
So they were opening the first of its kind. It was a farm-to-table restaurant, which I was wildly passionate about, because now this is after the point of having my career at the Westin Hotels and working with farms to schools and building those programs. I was able to go to the Museum of Science and Industry and say, I want to do something different with my career. I want to source product from local farms and build those relationships with those groups. But it's contract management.
Yep.
And so at that point, there was nothing really being done in that avenue to say, well, we can have procurement of you buying from a local farm, because you have to be really careful about your food sources when you're serving the public and when you're serving the masses. And so that kind of trickled me into a different career path of procurement, which I was wildly in love with. Like, I had always loved it. And when I was with the hotel, they said, we understand you want to pursue this as a career path, but it will be dissolved in the next few years. So don't do it with us. And I was like, well, that's kind of strange, right? Like,
really,
why would it be going away? And obviously they're the planners of the company, and so they know what's happening in the future. And so as I played with that idea at the Field Museum and I was really setting up these farm relationships, I was like, this is my true calling. This is what I love to do. And I was able to move into a sales position working for a small farm-to-table group here doing sales. And through those relationships, I built even further with the farmers. And that got me introduced to Rick Bayless. And so the irony there is, when I was the chef, as the executive chef at the Westin Indianapolis, they said, well, if you could work for any chef in the world, who would you work for? And I was like, Rick Bayless. They're like, really? And I was like, absolutely. I just had admired him from a perspective of how he treated his staff. And again, I'm modeling my career after people that I really want to make an impact. There's always those opportunities that people will come to you and say, hey, come and be on our cooking show. Come be on Chopped. Come be on, you know, whatever next Food Network thing that's popular. And I had to steer away from those. And that was really important in my career, because the opportunities were definitely there.
That's super cool.
But when I went through the interview process, I declined them, because I could see very easily they were trying to paint me into something I wasn't.
Yeah, I guess you would think it's probably more, it's all about reality.
It's drama.
Getting views. You look at something like Hell's Kitchen or whatever.
Yes.
And you, I don't know, I've watched some of those shows and I can't watch them, because I'm like, come on. Like, that's, these people are supposed to be, you know, decent level chefs or cooks or whatever their title is. And I'm like, come on, like, how could you burn that or not know that? Like, that's like one-on-one.
Yes.
I'm not saying, you know, I'm not the greatest by any means, but I look at it and I was like, yeah, I mean, I could go on there. But then you start to realize they want those personalities. They want the wild person that's going to fly off the handle that right. They know isn't going to win, but we need those personalities interjected right. In just to cause mad chaos in the kitchen.
Yes. And back when these interviews were happening, again, females in the industry were pretty limited. It wasn't well known that you could be an industry leader. You couldn't be an executive chef. Those titles weren't highly recognized and they weren't popular. And so when I was interviewed for them, they're like, oh, well, do you have tattoos? No, I don't have any. Oh, well, are you married? No. Well, your boyfriend. Do you have a boyfriend? Yeah. Well, he's got to hate the hours you work. I said, no, he's really supportive, right? Mm. And so every time they would try to paint me into a corner, I was like, yeah, no, this isn't working for me. I don't want to be something, because how would that carry on with any company that I was going to be looked towards? You know, if they painted me negatively or positively, that can impact my career path.
Especially nowadays.
Yes.
Back then, you obviously tech not near as big. Now,
oh,
they look at everything you've ever done 20, 30 years ago, and that would easily be on film and record.
Absolutely. And so that passion project of doing the procurement that led me to Rick Bayless, and I was eventually his culinary director for 7 years, opened stores across the country from Walt Disney World to Philadelphia to finally New York City. And that was going through COVID, and that changed the world. And I think that's when I had to take a pause and really do a gut check and say, is this where I want to be anymore? And the answer was no. And it's not because I fell out of love with Rick Bayless. I still love Rick Bayless. And it was a great position to have with them and to see the company grow leaps and bounds. But after COVID, the world changed and the passion was just not there anymore. And I wanted to get back to the people side of the business, which as a culinary director, I was doing that largely so in the training programs and the development. But because of COVID, we were so extremely short staffed that it was stuck in back of house the majority of time doing development and training and recipe writing, which is all fantastic and all things I like. But with the limited contact of COVID, I really wanted to get back out and have exposure to people. And so I had the opportunity to join Stan's as director of operations. And so I did that just 2 years ago. And it was a leap of faith. You know, I've sort of left the industry and come back in some capacity by saying, I am an executive chef of this property, or I'm doing this and I'm moving into sales, or I went from sales back into a culinary role. And so this one was wildly different because I'm no longer a chef, right? Like, it's in my blood, but in the end of the day, I'm an operator. And what does that look like? And how does it really portray who I am and who I want to be? And so I was really careful about how I came into it because everyone's like, oh, well, you're a chef and you know how this should taste and you know what this should look like. That's not my job anymore. And I'm largely passionate about my employees and the people who work for me and their livelihoods and how can we make the business better. And I let the chefs do what they need to do in the creative department. And so that's where I've been now with Stan's. I started as director of ops and 8 months later I was promoted to vice president of operations.
Wow. So what a journey.
Yeah.
That's incredible. What I'm noticing a lot more though are a lot of folks that do go the typical route, CIA, Johnson West, whatever culinary school, do apprenticeships, do their hard time. They realize, I don't know, somewhere down the line, I don't know if I want to just keep this grind going, especially nowadays.
Yes.
I've talked to a lot of chefs for a lot of different companies and they say, you know, it's great. Like you said, they want to get back to the people, you know, when you're in back of house all day and it's just your team, that's great.
Yeah.
But you're not getting that interaction with those out front as much. Whereas a lot of these chefs that are in these corporate type positions or even jumping over to operations, they get that chance. It's not the same back of house every day. It's, I got to go here and I got to go there and focus on the people, which is incredible. So I want to kind of go back to procurement for just a second, because I did that during COVID. I had to learn procurement during COVID. That's not fun in my opinion.
I love it.
Oh, so much. When you did procurement, was it more just on the, because there's so many facets to procurement.
Yeah.
And what I always try to understand is, was it just about, I did a ton of data analytics, which at the end of the day, just that's not, no, like I'm good at it, but sitting behind a computer all day, every day, I need to be out and talk to people. Hence creating a podcast so I can just talk to people, get the creative outlet. And so when you did procurement, was it more of, especially on the farm to table, was it just building the relationships? Did you have to kind of do everything? Did you have data analytics support? What was your kind of role with on the procurement side?
So it was largely finding the purveyors that can work for us and that had the safety rules and regulations in place. Whether I was sourcing for the museum or sourcing for Rick Bayless, we were both working in a dynamic field where you were exposing the highest risk populations. So you needed to ensure that, you know, the farmer that you were working with wasn't breaking cold chain or anything like that. So it was really about going out to find those farmers. And he had some existing relationships set up already. So I went out and interviewed with them and made sure that they were still following protocols. But it was the ability to really align them and have a strategy to say, we're growing and we need to know that you can grow with us. And that was how the relationships formed and looking into the contacts that I was able to build year after year and really saying like, okay, this cheese manufacturer has had several hiccups. Why is that happening? Going to visit their plant, looking at my production, looking at the data and saying, I use 1,000 pounds of cheese this week and I will do that for 6 consecutive weeks, but then I drop off to 200 pounds. Are you able to fluctuate your business that way? Does it need to be static? How can I help from a distributor perspective? So it's really sort of a culmination of all the things for me and tying it together and saying, is this a good fit for us or not a great fit? And trying to see, can they improve something down the way that would make them a potential good vendor to work with?
Yeah. And how far was the range that you guys kind of deemed as farm to table? You hear so many people will say farm to table in the Chicago region. It's not the easiest to go farm to table. So a lot of it will kind of stretch it and say, 300 miles. Which, yes, I mean, in the grand scheme of things of the United States, that's local. But what were you looking for?
In that particular time, it was any state that touched Illinois.
Okay.
So basically those surrounding states we were able to procure from. And we did a pretty solid job. I think that the most difficult item to source with the volume we needed was poultry. And that was a real challenge because, I mean, chicken is everyone's best friend. But now you see there's avian bird flu left and right.
Oh,
and
it's crazy. And now it's affecting the eggs. So I've seen. So they're just dumping. Has that affected stands at all?
It has.
Yeah.
It has.
Because I want to, now we're going to kind of dive back into stands. So you've been there for a few years and it was established recently, right? It's not one of those long 100-year type companies. So maybe a quick background of Stands, who Stands Donut is, and then we'll get in the nuts and bolts of, because you guys are doing a lot. I see it everywhere. So we'll get into what that looks like too.
We are. So it's actually been around for 10 years. We just celebrated our 10th anniversary in January. Rich Labriola, who's the owner of Stands Donuts, or one of the owners, was watching one of the food shows on cable TV, right? And they had done a small episode on the Stands in LA, which was basically a popular hot dog hamburger stand by the campus of UCLA. He made an initial contact and was like, I love what you're doing. You're serving food, but you also serve donuts like at 2 a.m. to these hungry college kids who are out having a great time and partying and studying late, right? And so initially when they built that relationship, Stan Berman didn't have interest in, you know, selling off a piece of his business or doing a partnership or extending that relationship. And of course, Rich wasn't trying to open in LA. But as time passed, they sort of formed this relationship where Stan could trust Rich to build the brand successfully in Chicago. And the first location was open in Wicker Park 10 years ago.
That's so cool.
Yeah. We unfortunately just lost Stan Berman this past January. Mm-hmm. So it was bittersweet. It was literally just 2 days before the 10th anniversary. Yeah. So
a little dagger, right?
Yeah. But yes.
You guys but celebrate, right, though, into the 10 years. You can now celebrate.
We celebrated.
Kind of how it all started and how it's brought everyone together. So you all have physical stores.
Yep.
And I do want to touch, because now I go to Costco. See Costco, Jewel. I'm like, they're everywhere. I'm like, Juan, they're everywhere. And I even give feedback because it's so funny. I'll be like, hey, because I know that his wife also works for you all. And I'm like, hey, give some feedback because what was it? I got some donuts or bread and it was like not even 2 days and it started to mold. Something happened.
Yeah.
And I was like, it said it was produced literally like today. I was like, that doesn't make any sense. And it was kind of funny because ipso facto, it came back and they're like, they found out that something wasn't happening right and it was causing it to break down faster. And I was like, oh, that's kind of funny that I told you that. And now, sure enough, it's being changed. So you got the physical stores. How many are you up to?
We have 17 owned and operated.
Wow. And are they all under one umbrella? Are they independent operators?
They're all under the Doughboy Restaurant Group.
Okay. Doughboy Restaurant Group. So then you're selling donuts all day. Well, what are the hours? I guess I should ask first.
The majority of our brick and mortar stores, we are open from 6 a.m. until 8 p.m. Now, a handful of stores do close at 7 p.m. One store might open at 7 a.m. But generally speaking, it's 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. And that's a new change for us. We have those 17 owned and operated stores. And then we have a partnership that we do with Mariano's and the Museum of Science and Industry. And so with those other locations, that's largely when I started 2 years ago, they had one partnership with Mariano's. And then I was tasked with opening a windfall of stores. And so now we are quickly up to another 11 store locations.
Oh my gosh.
And then we have more partnerships happening this year.
So the Mariano's, they're little stands inside of the actual grocery store, which you'd see. I mean, I guess most people listening probably are used to seeing Jewel and a Starbucks inside or something of that nature. Same thing. Now, are you giving the full option array at within those markets, or is it a little different than the stores?
So what we've had to do for our partnerships with Mariano's is to streamline the business. And so we offer the most popular donut varieties in theirs. And so at any given point, Stan stores have 46 donut varieties, but our operating partners will have 23 different varieties because that customer is quite different than my customer that's coming into a store to have a coffee and a donut for that, or a breakfast sandwich for that matter. And so it's very different demographics that we're playing into here. We're going for convenience, someone who is already shopping at the grocery store. Maybe they have their kids in tow and they just wanted to pop in for a quick donut. So they didn't need the variety that we had at our store locations. And the variety is sometimes the worst of what we can offer. You know, trying to not upset the guests because you're out of their favorite donut is hard.
Oh, yeah.
It's hard. And, you know, but being able to plan accordingly is even tougher, right? So much can play into how we are doing business. The weather, whether it's a convention in town, maybe somebody had a large pre-order because that's the world we live in now after COVID. Everybody's ordering online. And they take out your favorite donut. So your favorite donut is the Le Stand donut, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. I've got that right.
If you went into the store at 2 p.m, those donuts may not be there, especially if it's a weekend.
Oh my God. It's so good. I'm going to zoom in on this for people. Explain what the Le Stand is, because so, it is not your typical donut.
No, the Le Stand is a laminated croissant donut that's been fried, and it has a vanilla pastry cream on the inside.
Brad, can you get me a napkin? Like, I'm going to be like covered in sugar. It's so good. Absolutely so good. It's my favorite. Like I told you, I'm that guy that just stands there. I'm like, what do I want? Do I want to try something new?
Right.
Do I want the original? And I guess that leads me to the question of, how do you find a balance of the staples, people wanting that, hey, I want to come in and I want my typical cake donut. Like, I want that Long John.
Yeah.
But at the same time, pushing the boundaries of being innovative and saying, well, how do we take it? There's so many different things. We've got the Cruffin, which is a cupcake or a croissant muffin, which can't wait to try that. How do you find the balance between the two?
I think that it's really a struggle, and we look at a lot of data to make these difficult decisions, and it's never a permanent hold. And so if I was to tell you, you know, because we've introduced the Cruffin, we're going to take away the Le Stand. That's not the reality, but hypothetically speaking, we look at the performance over the majority of the stores, how they're selling, what it's, you know, the waste amount that we're, you know, generating, and what are people genuinely interested, or is it just what we thought was a good idea versus is it actually generating sales? And we have to make tough decisions. And so if I was to take that donut away and out of the rotation right now, it would be simply a pause to bring it back at a time of year that we can reintroduce it back into the market where we don't have so much craziness going on.
That makes sense.
Because right now we have 46 donut varieties, but when I get into fall, everyone loves fall and donuts and apple cider donuts.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and our collection suddenly becomes 53 to 54 varieties. And it's like, that might not seem like a big deal.
No, that's a lot of SKUs.
But that's a big deal. And it's really fascinating to see our location just scale and build up that volume, because it also ties into the time of year. Everybody's now indulging again versus the summertime. They're eating a little bit healthier, just going to cold drinks, having a sandwich rather than a donut. And so it's a real challenge on how to say, we're going to retire this donut for a little while versus just constantly being on the innovation trail and bringing in a new donut. At one point, Stan's used to introduce new flavors daily, and then it went to weekly. And then when COVID happened, I believe, if I remember correctly, this time is before me, so I don't want to misspeak, but I believe there are around 63 varieties.
Jeez.
And so that is a labor of love, because there are multiple doughs and multiple variations of it. That's what makes Stan's genuinely unique compared to other donut companies that I've seen in Chicago, is that our doughs are not basic with a flavored topping. The dough is flavored. And so if I told you, you know, there's 7 different old fashioned, you know, varieties, and each one of them have their own dough, when you scale into volume, that becomes a real challenge.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, anyone who's ever seen any sort of manufacturing facility, they're mind blowing. The parts, the pieces, yes, the run lines, the minimums you want to run, because to change out a line could cost you X amount of dollars, you know, between the teams that have to switch it out, not to mention cleaning it.
Yeah.
It's a production. It's not, people think it's just, oh, it's just manufacturing, they can just change over. No, it's a whole process to change over a facility in the lines. Like you said, different doughs require different equipment,
yeah,
or different cuts, like those stands a square versus a round versus, you know, hole in the center. There's so many fascinating pieces to that. That still blows my mind, that thinking that that many donuts. Now, outside of donuts and coffee, what else are the shops selling? Because being open till 8 o'clock, I mean, don't get me wrong, I could eat donuts all day, and we're recording it mid-afternoon, so I will gladly eat donuts any time of the day. But being open till 8 o'clock, I'm sure there's going to be some other things that people would want.
Absolutely. So it was just about 2.5 years ago, they introduced what was then a breakfast program. So to give you that backstory of Rich Labriola, he was a baker by trade. And so he used to own Labriola Baking. And everyone is connected by 6 degrees of separation. I love that. Mm-hmm. So you and I know we have someone in common. We have two people in common. I actually knew Rich as he used to produce the bread when I was working for Rick Bayless. And so when I transitioned over to working for him, it was like sort of like, oh, a quick catch up of like, hey, I know you. Did you remember that we did this 8 years ago? And so as he was originally a bread baker, he sold that company off. And when we introduced breakfast to the company, he was once again making bread, just on a small scale for Stan's Donuts only. And he started with brioche. And it was the most fascinating thing because everyone thought, well, it'd be nice to have a breakfast sandwich in addition to donuts. But the reality became widely known that it was a great quality breakfast. It wasn't a frozen product that was being unpacked from a major broadliner and here's your egg puck. All of these things were freshly made and produced and assembled for you at the store level, you know, to order, which, you know, it's not fast food. We're not built to be fast food. And so we have really tiny operating spaces because no one thought that breakfast was going to be anything. And it quickly took off and it makes up, you know, about a fourth of our business.
Really?
So it went from just a simple sandwich to now we have 7 different offerings and they're offered all day, which is my favorite part. Because how many times do you go to those other guys that have the big golden arches and it's like, oh, it's not 10 o'clock anymore. You can't have your sandwich. Yeah. And I'm a breakfast for dinner kind of person anyways. So to get one of our great offerings any time of day is amazing. The cafes were really created with the ambiance that we invite you to stay. We want to welcome you in. We want you to dine in our space. We want you to get a coffee, a donut, come back and have a breakfast sandwich or a grilled cheese at this point. The ham and cheese on pretzel baguette is like my favorite.
Pretzel, you say pretzel bread, period, and sold. Put anything on it, I will eat it.
It's fantastic. And it's just ever so slightly warm, so it's melty and gooey. And that's really his signature item. So he was the first to create pretzel bread in the Chicagoland market. So we really have this fascinating story with this bread baker who goes into the donut business to return to his roots of being a bread baker again. And it's really evolved the business to become, you know, full circle for him. And that's wildly fascinating because I love to tell people who get into this industry that you don't have to be just one thing, right? Mm-hmm. We talk about, I started it and I was a cook and then I worked my way up as a sous chef and then I was a chef and then I went to procurement, I was in sales and now I'm in operations and now I'm the vice president of operations. And you're like, well, how do you do all those things? And how did you learn all of that stuff? And did you go to school for any of that? And it's like, well, yeah, sure. Of course you learn a core amount at school, but it's a lot of experience based too, right? And so often when you'd be up for a promotion, I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but I'd be up for this promotion, a big one, and they'd be like, you're so close, but you're just a little bit too young. And I was like, what does that mean?
Oh yeah. I hate the I call it reverse age discrimination.
Yeah.
Cause I had my first kitchen when I was 28. And everybody in the kitchen was older than me. Yeah. Everyone that reported to me was older than me. And it was tough. But what I luckily learned, again, going back to my kind of my farm roots, I respected everybody.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, you need to call me chef. Yes, chef. It was like, let's have fun. We're all here for the same goal as to
feed. Exactly.
We're feeding the masses. Like you said, when you're feeding 5,000 meals a day, you got to have your ducks organized and you just have to play nice in the sandbox. Mm-hmm. And I think over time, people just gain the respect.
They do.
That's how I perceive someone who takes on that title of chef. It wasn't, oh, I went to school, so now I'm entitled. I had zero. I didn't know how to run a kitchen. You kidding me? Like I worked in the casino world, got my butt kicked, did the typical line. So I knew all that stuff, but I never ran an operation that magnitude. But luckily, someone who I worked for, you know, how we always travel, usually with someone that we know, was like, I know he works hard and I'm going to give him a shot. And that's how I got that kitchen. And it was just randomly one day, you know, with my name being Jeff, ironically, one of the older cooks said, hey, chef, can you pass me or can you get me? And I had to like stop. And I was like, I think that's what they said. But maybe they just said my name. And I didn't think anything else of it. And then as I fast forward now, you know, many years past, I kind of look back and I go, I think that's the time that I actually got the stripes and people respected me to call me that. And again, to today, it's like, if you want to call that great, I don't care either way.
Right.
That's my background, but that's not what defines who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And to your point, there's so many things you can do in this industry with the kind of background. And it's great to diversify. I love people who are inquisitive and are always asking questions. And what about this? And what about that? And it leads you to some of these really cool jobs that you otherwise wouldn't be, because you're pigeonholed of, nope, I got to go the route of, I have to become a sous chef and then an executive sous chef. And then I'll become an executive chef. And I don't know about you, but I had that same fire in my belly when I was told, you need to be in a position like this for 10 years in order to be even a sous chef at a magnitude of this type of place. It pissed me off.
Exactly.
And I was like, you watch. And sure enough, it was like a year and a half later, there I was. And I was like, I never went back and said, ha, look, I was just like, you know what? I did it. And that proves anyone can make it if you just, but you got to put in the hard work, the dedication. So we've got all these stores. Then I happen to be roaming the aisles of Jewel and I see a Stan's donut box and I'm like, oh my God, now they're in the stores. Now I can get donuts anytime. And then I'm magically at Costco and boop, there Stan's again. So what's it like getting into that side of the business? I have no inkling. Grocery stores have always fascinated me and I've always wanted to know more about the grocery store, but that's, to me, almost, I don't want to say it's secret world, but it feels like it's its own world that unless you kind of like get in it. So maybe talk about what it's like getting into those type of places, logistical challenges. I'm assuming your procurement background had something to do with helping that happen.
So that was always the end goal for Rich is to get into retail and to get into the grocery stores and make it a product that you can get, whether you're in San Francisco or you're in Chicago. COVID expedited that. And so COVID really made everyone pivot. And in 2020, you know, as we were told to stay home for 2 weeks, right? The world was shutting down. Uh-huh. I was still with Bayless at this time and we had a new store. We were just open for 3 months at that point at Willis Tower. Go figure. And, you know, we see people walking out with their plants. And 2 weeks turns into four and four turns into eight and so on and so forth. And we've all lived that story now and we don't need to rehash it, but everybody was fighting to stay alive. And the team at Stan's had to quickly pivot and say, how are we going to remain relevant at a point where people don't want to come out, they can't socialize, but everybody needs to get to the grocery store. And everybody needs groceries. And we have the capacity to make these donuts at volume and get them out to the grocery realtors. And so there have been a ton of learning points along the way. Trust me. I mean, nobody's ever fully ready to be like, oh, hey, I'm in retail food service, right?
Yeah.
And so just transitioning from the concept that you're no longer in control of your product, which is hard. It is really hard. And so at our stores, the donuts are made fresh every single day. We are the quality checkers. We're selling them at the end of the night. They're gone. And that's really a premise of our storefronts. But when you get into retail, you're turning over a case of product and you're hoping that they've put the right date stamp on it. Was it the right number of days? Was it held in the proper conditions before it was sold? Was it accidentally frozen or was it held in the loading dock where it's 110 degrees and the chocolate's melted off? And so really putting your trust in other partners to put your product on display and have it displayed to your standards, it's a real challenge. And it's something that we continue to just revisit on a continuous basis. What do the clients want in a grocery store? How is it different than our own stores? And who is the right partner that we can trust with the quality and the integrity that we want this product to be out there? And that is so important because we don't have a ton of fillers in our product to keep it on the shelf for 30 days.
Yeah.
It's very limited number of days compared to the other producers that are out there. And that's what makes it a little scary and intimidating, because you're ready to go to market and you're in the retail business and you're suddenly in 100 different Costcos across the city, or, you know, multiple states, even if you consider that. And now you have mass exposure, and that can make or break you as a business, because the people who come into your Chicago stores, because that's where we're at right now with our storefronts, when they come in, they know you for something. But when they go to South Carolina and they get their donuts at that Costco, it's quite different. And if it's a positive review, it's like, wait, I didn't have this type of donut in your store. How did, like, why is it so different, or why is it better? Or conversely, why is it not the same?
Right.
And so really learning how can we control the quality and trust these other operating partners has been a big proponent as to how we will grow that side of the business, and why do we have such a limited number of offerings?
Yeah, I mean, it makes total sense. So what does a VP of operations do, right? There's so many hats that I think get worn, to be honest.
Yeah.
From what I know. But what is a typical day in Kim's life look like? I'm sure that they're all different to a degree. But really, what's kind of that pinnacle? Like, I got to focus on these things today. Or does it just truly just constantly jump around?
I will say that this is not a traditional vice president job. It is something that takes a lot of organization, not saying that any other vice president job doesn't, but we're still sort of in that gray area. We're not quite a small company anymore because we have 31 locations, right? Yep. But we're not quite a big company that we have this major corporate infrastructure, that we have 25 people on corporate that can help if I'm not feeling well and I need to take the day off. Well, it's not quite set up that there's 12 other people to step into my place and do the things I need to do. Now, we've introduced a bit more structure in the past 2 years, but it is still a wild goose chase most days, putting out fires.
Yeah.
And for the better part of a year, I would say there was a lot of employee turnover, staffing issues, and just trying to get them to come to these new terms, because many people who had worked through COVID knew one version of the brand. And through that evolution of, I guess we'll say postpartum COVID, I don't know what part of COVID.
That's a good term.
Maybe we're in the middle, maybe we're on the end. I'm not sure where we are, but I don't want it to come back. So I don't want to jinx it. So here's some wood. But quite honestly, we had a lot of people that went through that transition to say, this is what I know working with stands at COVID life to be like, and we needed to come out of that. We needed to change our productivity. We needed to wear multiple hats, and getting the brand to be back relevant and scaling up with the office occupancy was really important to say, like, we have enough bodies in place to do this. And at times we were overstaffed when it was like we thought the world was coming back, but it actually wasn't.
Yeah, it definitely did not.
We're still work from home Monday and Friday. If it's raining or if it's snowing, people are still working from home. They're not going to come to the office. And so building that business and looking at it from the vice president's perspective of, like, how do we create the stable environment? There's a well-being for our employees that we need to watch out for. And we need to offer them a form of stability. And so we try to find the right balance of hours to be open, what's functionally operational, what's a necessity, and how do we really progress and make sure that our employees are taken care of? Because for so long, the stores had such limited hours that it was a single shift that you would run.
Yeah.
Now you're back to running 2.5 shifts, if you will, just based on our shift time length with being open from 6 to 8. And so one of the largest changes that I made was that I advocated to open the stores earlier. And you would think as a coffee and donut shop that that was like premise number one, that we were open 5, 4 a.m. like most bakeries. When I came on, we were only opening at 7. And I was like, what?
There's a lot of people already getting into the office at that
point. Yeah, it was like, what do you mean 7 o'clock? And so it was like, no, we need to come in and open earlier. And they're like, right, but we can't. And I'm like, why? And it goes into, well, we have this many donuts and we have to make all these donuts and it takes us this many hours. And I'm like, right. So like, let's cut down the number of donuts. Let's open earlier and streamline and scale efficiently. And it certainly has the bumps along the way, but I think we've gotten to a really good place. So generally speaking, it's the fires that need to be put out. It's looking at the financials. It's looking how to strategically grow the business, how to create succession planning, and really finding the people who want to work with the company, not, you know, just for a couple of hours, but who are really looking to build a career path. Because the one main thing I found after COVID was the industry has changed. I don't know that we're ever going to go back to
no way
what it was. The fun times that I used to have of cursing all the time and saying all the bad words, English, Spanish, maybe pick a new language these days. I think those days are long gone. And what we came out of COVID learning is that there is life outside of work for people. And we need to be cognizant of that.
Yes, we do.
Because if we're not, we're just going to lose them to another employer who will. And it's never been more evident that we need to have a work-life balance. And what does that mean, right? Like in 2024, what is a work-life balance? Can you work Monday through Friday in this industry? Not generally speaking, right? Especially donuts. Our busiest times are Saturdays and Sundays. And so we've tried to be really clear, really explicit in our interviewing process and saying, you do understand we're very busy on the weekends and we need you to be here. Can you commit to that? Can you commit to holidays? Because those are the days that we're open that people want to celebrate with Sands. Yep. We would be nothing without our customers. And so to have that perspective and sharing that with our team, building the culture, that's kind of my job on the daily basis, is like trying to rebuild the culture life after COVID.
I love hearing that because I don't think a lot of people take enough into account of how the staff is treated, actually caring about the employees.
Yeah.
Everyone's so worried about the bottom line and how much are we paying people? And oh my gosh, it's minimum wage is raising. However, if you find the right people, you treat them properly. Like you said, set the expectations up front. This is what it's going to be like. If this is for you, great. Let's continue. If not, this is not for you. And that is okay.
Right.
And then you pay people accordingly. People will stay. There are people who want, that don't want, you know, to go up and up and up and up.
Right.
Some people are happy with kind of the, you know, the nine to five.
Yeah.
But they want that stable life. They just want to be around their family, et cetera, and not be worried about constantly working. And, you know, because in our industry, it feels as if it never shuts off. Ever.
No.
Doesn't matter if it's a holiday or a weekend. It feels like at any given moment, an email is going to come through and I've got to answer this, or somebody needs something and you feel almost obligated to answer it. And what I found is that it's funny when all of a sudden you just don't. The world keeps turning and it's amazing how it keeps turning. And I think I pivoted. Again, let's knock on some wood. I think early on, I realized, especially when I had kids, that I'm not going to be doing this 12 hour, 13, 14 hour stuff, you know, work at missing everything.
Yes.
No, I'm going to be there for them when it's important. And that's what I want in my life and molding. So I love to hear that you take care of your people. Now, just on the labor in general, are you doing anything from, you know, I know there's robots and just other technology, other things that you're incorporating in to help, because there just sometimes there just isn't enough people.
So I think that's a wild concept to play with. If you would have asked me 10 years ago if we would be considering any type of robot, the answer would be absolutely not, right? And that's as a chef, right? And so I think that's really interesting to see where the industry was to where it is today, from the most basic things of chopping an onion. It comes in pre-chopped now. Yeah. Because there's not enough labor. There's not enough workforce. And so at what point are you willing to trade quality for quantity?
Yeah.
And so I say that because at this point in time, no, we're not looking to incorporate any type of robots or, you know, any AI into what we do. But to look at the success of our company in the future lens, to say we have high quality employees that we need to keep and retain, we need to pay them a living wage, because that's what's come out of COVID. Our industry needs a living wage.
Yep.
I never debated that. But some of the restrictions that have been imposed upon us in such a short time frame of this industry, I mean, imagine you've gone from 1950 to to 2000 and everybody knows you make terrible money. It's not a good industry to be in. You make money off of overtime, right? Like that's your bread and butter. And so to go from something that used to make $7 an hour to making $15 an hour nowadays is wildly dramatic. And for a small business, that's a real challenge. So the systems that we're putting into place are sort of in the back end. That's not exactly affecting the number of employees we would hire, but it's trying to streamline our business in other ways, looking at waste reduction, which is so important. Yes, if I have 46 different donut varieties and I forecast it the wrong way, it's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
And throwing away 46 donuts, multiply by 2, 3, 4, you know, that's rough. And so we have systems that are technology based. You know, we're using an online aggregator to sort of group our orders together and really to start looking at our volumes and our production so we can get ahead of the curve. And so our next big holiday coming up is Mother's Day. And Mother's Day at Stan's Donuts is unlike anything I've done in the industry. Now, I'm a mom. I love donuts. Never did I put the two together on Mother's Day. Never. I mean, I always worked on Mother's Day. It was Mother's Day brunch, right?
Right.
And I had children. I have a daughter who's 7 now and a son who's 6. I still don't think I've put donuts and moms together. It is wildly fascinating to see what happens and how it happens at Stan's on Mother's Day. The number of people that come in, and it's not, you're not coming in for one or two donuts. You're coming in for dozens of donuts. Yep. And so if we can do anything to this industry and to set the precedent for the future, is that pre-order, because that allows me to guarantee I have your favorite donut.
Right.
And that changes the way we operate as a business. How do I do this successfully, making you happy as a client, as a guest, because you are my livelihood for this business? But then to be forward thinking, to say I have enough staff to accommodate this number of orders that's on. That's really the technology we're incorporating into our business. So it's back-end data analytics rather than customer facing.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people are hesitant, you know, it's a bakery, it's a donut shop. Why do I want to pre-order my donuts? Well, I mean, why would I do that? Well, we need to get them to understand from a consumer standpoint that production is limited. We can only do so much. And if you really want your Le Stan donut, you're going to have to pre-order it so we don't run out and you're not unhappy. We don't want to lose you to the competition, but we also have to remain profitable. And that is where we need to find the balance between the number of donuts we have, the most popular, the least popular, retiring a favorite right now and bringing it back so there's some excitement down the road. It's really trying to find a balance between all of it and not pushing it too far too fast.
Yeah. Are you seeing more pre-orders and online nowadays than ever before? I would think I don't know how you get people to understand. It's almost like Punchkies.
Yeah.
Everyone knows when Punchkies come right. Yep. You have to usually get them a couple days in advance. You just do, because it's very limited time around Fat Tuesday and you can get them. Yes, the stores may have, but they say it's bold and blunt. What we've got is what we got. If you want more, you need to pre-order. And it's kind of the same thing. But what percentage would you think is that online versus just stop in? Maybe it doesn't have to be the onesie twosie, but that large.
The larger ones, I would say we're probably successfully at 20%.
Okay.
I mean, and you have to look at this business as, you know, a hand of wild cards. You can randomly get an order for 12 dozen donuts and you're like, well, that's no big deal, right? But for some stores, that could be a third of their inventory, because on a normal Tuesday, we would sell 400 donuts at that store.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it's administrative professional day and somebody dropped the ball and forgot to order the donuts. And so they go to the store and they get the 12 dozen and it's like, great, we're going to take the sale. Absolutely. But now for that customer that comes in every day at 2 p.m., their experience is quite different.
Right.
And so we really need to get people to understand that, yeah, of course, we're here to accommodate you. We're a bakery and a donut shop, and we sell your coffee all day long, and we have your refreshers too. But truthfully, what can we do to be proactive in this together? Because small businesses are eroding at a rapid rate.
Oh, yeah. It's just between wage compression, like you said, the labor issues, like you said, forecasting, product sourcing, costs have gone up, and it doesn't feel like they've really kind of came back down to earth. Nope. Like everything else. They feels like a lot of suppliers have been like, we can kind of keep it, and here's the new bottom benchmark, and then we'll continue to do a 3% off of this new baseline. It's like, wait, you didn't come down to earth like everyone else did, and it shouldn't cost. But in some industries, I could see where it didn't come down because of labor issues. Others, I think that there should be some room, but, you know, who am I? I don't know everything. Let's jump in the weeds. Kitchen quote. If your kitchen had a motto, what would it be?
Do the right thing, even if no one's watching.
I love it. Integrity.
Yeah. And I would say that has carried for so long in my career, because even if I didn't get that promotion right when I deserved it, in my mind, eventually things came full circle and it all worked out the way that it was supposed to work out. But I would say there's a number of opportunities in life where you can choose to still do the right thing or the wrong thing. And that's going to play out for you in a way of karma coming down the road, some capacity.
You ever find yourself at home, maybe it's me and the training, same thing. Even if I'm like cutting a carrot or something for a particular dish, I'm like, I got to like square off my hands. I'll still use them, but in a different capacity. Yep. And I'm like, nobody's, who cares? My kids don't care if this carrot is a perfect, you know, 1-inch cube. They just want to eat it. Do you ever find yourself at home doing that?
I do.
Maybe it's just ingrained in our bones, but I can't get away from it at home. Next one, kitchen pet peeve. What's one thing home cooks do that drive you crazy? This could be visiting friends, family, events, but you watch and you're just like, you just want to, but you bite your tongue.
I don't understand this concept of washing poultry. I don't get it.
I don't either.
I don't get it. I mean, they've not sanitized the sink. They haven't done anything there, but they're like, yeah, I'm going to rinse this chicken off because it is dirty. And I'm like, all right, well, that would have cooked off in the oven, and then they don't go back to clean the sink. So that's my pet peeve.
Oh, yeah, the sanitation. Mine is definitely like the dirty cutting board.
Yeah.
They've got 100 things. They're chopping your vegetables. And like in a kitchen, when you have a new cook, all of a sudden the cutting board turns into this little section they're trying to cut on. And I'm like, come on, let's get a waste bin. Let's get something to put your food in when you're done with it. I try not to jump in, but it's so hard sometimes because you're just like, it's a mess. It's just a bomb blew up on their cutting board. It drives me nuts. Morning person or night owl?
Morning. I'm in donuts for a reason.
that's a good point. Well, most chefs are night people, right? They do the night thing and then, you know, they kind of sleep until, you know, the midday rolls and they do their thing. So
I was never a good night person. I mean, I worked plenty of weddings and catering functions, but it was, you know, I was always up. It's first thing the sun comes up, I'm awake. You see that daylight, I have to be productive. So I'm sort of the opposite of the world where it's like a gray, gloomy day. And I'm like, oh, thank God I could take a day off, right? Like I can rest. Otherwise the sun's out, I need to be productive and I've just got to be going.
Yeah. Love that. Order in or cook out? Or cook.
Okay. So to be fair, life before kids, it was 110%. I'm always cooking in. But now as family has sort of evolved, I've got two food allergies at home.
Oh,
that's one, kind. My husband developed an egg allergy through COVID.
Ooh, that's rough.
And he loves eggs. So that was like, wild.
How severe? Like, is it buy stuff in it? Like, you know how, like, with different allergies, it can be the byproducts of an egg or whatever when they're baking, you know, and it could be raw versus baked.
Yep. So we've not quite found out the amount he can have without having a reaction. We tried that one egg in a batch of cookies or in one egg in a cake. That hasn't worked yet.
Oh.
And so he's got a lot of GI issues if he consumes eggs. So sometimes he has blamed me for bringing home snacks. And I'm like, hey, like, why are you eating that brioche? And he's like, why? And I'm like, that has eggs in it. And he's like, you didn't tell me that. And I was like, I also didn't tell you to eat it. So there's that.
Fair point.
So now with crazy work hours and crazy kid schedules, I would say it's a 50-50. I love to cook. I still will always love to cook. I love getting my kids in the weeds with me and just making a mess and making a lot of memories that way. But sometimes for, you know, lack of time.
Oh, yeah, there's
convenience.
You get home and you're, I don't want to cook. I don't want to do anything. I just want food to be ready, especially when you're around, even just if it's just donuts. When you're around food all day, it's a misconception. Everyone thinks that spouses of chefs eat like these king and queens and that we cook fine dining meals. It's like, no, frozen pizzas, hot dogs, corn dogs, chicken nuggets. Like the air fryer is my best friend.
I love the air fryer.
I use it every night. Every night, whether that be French fries, sweet potato fries, the chicken, the corn, everything goes in the air fryer.
Everything.
Everything. Best friend. Last one. Any food that you absolutely refuse to eat?
No, I don't have a refusal.
No?
No.
Okay, what's the biggest dislike then? Where you're just like, all right, I'll eat it, but reluctantly.
Reluctantly, all right. Reluctantly, I would eat canned tuna.
I don't know. There's something about it just being in a can just makes me.
It smells like cat food.
It does smell like cat food.
Get over that smell. Like, it's just like a sort of a gag reflex. It's like, oh, I don't want to eat that. Like, I can't smell it and say, oh yeah, that smells so good. I want to have it.
No,
it's not there for me.
People are like tuna salad. I'm like, no,
no, mm-mm. Pass.
If it's not just raw or seared, no, tuna, mm-hmm. Not for me. Those are all my in the weeds questions. Where do folks go to learn more about you, about Stan's Donuts?
Stansdonuts.com.
Stansdonuts.com.
Or stop into any of our locations. I float every single day, so I'm always in a store. I don't have an office. The stores are my office, and I love to chat with people. A lot of times I am just undercover, and I'm working the line, and I'm helping a customer, and they're like, oh, could you please tell those people to bring back the salted caramel old-fashioned? I'm like, yeah, I am those people. You know, so it's really fascinating to hear from the customers firsthand what they want to see, because we all have our own ideas, but it's really maybe not the reality of what a customer wants.
Okay, last question, because I just thought of it. Yeah. When are you doing a maple bacon donut? You've got a maple donut, but not a maple bacon donut.
Do you know why that is?
No, I'm very curious, because that is my ultimate, like, if the place has maple bacon, I'm going for it because I love bacon.
So if you're lucky enough and someone is nice enough to you, you can come visit us Father's Day weekend. Okay, so there's your hint.
Okay.
But honestly, if you go to any of our store locations and ask them to add it, they will add it for a maple donut. So we can't produce those at scale because our facility that we produce at, we're not allowed to have raw animal products. So we can't legally produce those. So everything we do has to be produced at our store levels, which, you know, can be a little bit challenging depending on day of the week it is.
I love it. There you go. That's the restaurant hack. Every place has got it. That's the hack. You go into the store and ask them to add that bacon to the donut. I bet it's life-changing, especially because it's real fresh bacon, not just some bagged frozen, you know, cheap stuff.
Can I have you try the cruffin? Because I'd like to see how you eat the cruffin.
I was gonna not force the people to have to listen to me munch on this if you're listening and watch me eat, but I'm not gonna say no by any means. Oh my god, look at this.
So that's largely based on Hougoumont, where you've got the layers of sugar and the croissant dough sort of layered in between each other. So you're going for it. You're biting it from the top. I love it.
Oh, I'm going for the cream.
Okay. So
Brad's just dying back here to like make a mess of myself. Now
I know. Do you
mean
Seinfeld?
No.
Okay.
I know Seinfeld, but never really watched it.
So there's the muffin top episode. And, you know, Elaine tries to make a bunch of the muffin tops and then she's throwing away the stumps. I am the stump person. I won't eat the top. Like
the top's my favorite.
Rip it off. Oh. And then I'm eating all the crystallized sugar on the bottom. It's so delicious. So I need to know, does that replace your favorite Lestan?
No. It doesn't. Really? It doesn't replace my Lestan. Okay. No.
All right, fair.
I get what Juan was saying when he says it's light and airy, but it's still dense, mm-hmm. which it's a concept that you're just like, it's hard until you eat it. Don't get me wrong, this is delicious. As I've only eaten, you know, most of the top. Does it replace my favorite? No. This guy right here, I don't know if it'll ever. Oh my God. People, if you're watching and you can see this, you have to go to Stan's Donuts, period. Get their donuts. If not, try them in the store, even if that's your intro or your teaser. They're all over the Chicago market in Jewel, Mariano's, almost every grocery store here in Chicago. If not, I don't know, do you guys ship across the U.S.?
We do. We use Gold Belly.
So there you go. And you can even get them shipped across the country. So get yourself some donuts, okay, from Stan's Donuts. Kim, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I appreciate you bringing the donuts. So Apologies to all those listening and watching and having to hear me eat these things. But until next time, we'll catch you on the sunny side.
Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.